that they become so deeply ingrained in our minds that we adopt them as we grow up.
Go ahead.
That, you know, like a young girl growing up is taught that she has to be demanding and whiny and stuff like that, and therefore adopts that. And Jewish mothers, you know, are given a stereotype, and they learn from their mothers, and they become like that. Mm-hmm. So that we're learning. It's a learned process.
Okay. The question was, I'm going to repeat it just in case some didn't hear. Is this possibly a learned process, something that Jews grow into? I think on some degree it is a learned process. I don't say that, you know, you won't, I can find few people I know who fit this imagery perfectly. Some Jews, some non-Jews. There are people who do behave that way. By the way, one thing I would, for those people who learn the process, I would correct you, is that it's learned as much from fathers as it is from mothers. It's not mother teaching daughter and that kind of thing. See, I see it as an expression of American nouveau riche, newfound wealth, newfound success. This America, newfound materialism. You compare the America of the 70s and the 80s with America of the 50s and 60s. The degree of material comforts is overwhelmingly increased today compared to what it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. It is a general expression of American society. I see it as a possibly cultural class expression, but not something that is limited to one group. I do think there are people who, certainly not understanding the manifestation or the expression of the stereotype, and I've talked to groups and talked about this work and some of my reading, my analysis, and people standing up to me say, I see what you're getting so excited about. I'm a Jap and I'm proud of it. Because it means, you know, my daddy took care of me. And someone's saying that. My father said I'd never, you know. Well, when you think about, certainly that someone said you can be taken care of and all those kind of things, that's very nice, you know, if you find an extra person out there, I'm here. On the other hand, I think when people fail to realize the impact, that, again, it's the sort of dismissing it as simply a joke, an expression of humor. Yeah. The latter part of your question and comment, you focused on the material success, but initially you said achievement intellectual, I think, as well, or, you know, that was a great emphasis. When you marry and have children, will you tell your son or your daughter, do not work too hard so that, because you might be so successful as to get into Cornell University, and then the non-Jews in your society will say you're overachieving, you know, don't work too hard and don't be too successful. In other words, I think what you're saying is, and I want to quote Alan Dershowitz, who talked about, recently I was talking to him about anti-Semitism in the United States, and Professor Dershowitz, Harvard Law School, many I'm sure know of him, said, sure, there are people who will use as an excuse for their anti-Semitism Jews' achievement. And he wasn't talking about it in terms of the prince or the princess, but just, and he said, but, to quote, oy vavoy to anyone who would say to their child, don't be as successful as you possibly can, you know, without hurting others, but within your own achievements, in order to avoid expression of anti-Semitism. So I think that we run of what we do, and what I hear in your question to some degree is an internalization of the myth. And I don't mean myth by true and untrue. We have historian of religions here who can talk to us about the meaning of myth. Internalization of the myth, and then a sort of ex post facto explanation. There is a Jewish emphasis on achievement. Initially it used to be, be a Talmud Chacham, be a yeshiva bachar, be a scholar. But always was that emphasis on material security, in part as a reaction to the vagaries and inconsistencies of external life. But again, I'm not sure that this comes simply from that. I think what you're saying has some small part. I think these all put together have a small part. But what I would question is that if you look at the Jewish population of the United States, however you want to define nouveau riche, and I sort of use that term freely. I mean, we'd have to define what we mean by it, but certainly that's not limited or even majority in terms of numbers to Jews. So I think maybe in your circle, maybe those whom you associate with or you know. But I think if you go outside of the great metropolis or state of New York or other places in California, you find that there are many parts of the United States where you have this nouveau riche imagery, certainly yuppies, and it's not simply a Jewish manifestation, but the stereotype is a Jewish manifestation.
Thank you. Cool bunch.
Yeah. I think it's sad when Jews have to express their or any group has to express their Jewishness by putting down other members of their group. I would hope that people would have enough education, identification, whatever, as a positive manifestation. I'm not one of them. Or it's the flip side of people saying, well, Jews do this and that, but you're different. Blacks do this and that, but saying to a black, but you're different, whatever it might be. And I think that it's a very disturbing manifestation because it fits right into the syndrome. And I know exactly what you're talking about. And I think it's a disturbing kind of thing. There's someone who's being climbed over who had her hand up, right? It's very hard. A friend of mine, Susan Widman Schneider, who is the editor of Lilith Magazine, gave me a great way of reacting, because I gave her, the problem of the dinner party where you have the choice. Am I going to ruin this dinner party by saying, this is unacceptable or stop or something like that? And her response, at least her response at the moment until she comes, she said she comes up with something better, is she says to someone, please don't tell me that joke because I might laugh and that would be socially unacceptable or, that would be unacceptable. You don't know what to do. But I think just as I wouldn't, in my house, when I was growing up, or certainly now, I could not see letting someone sit around making racist kind of jokes. I just won't allow it. I just ask people. I don't let people smoke in my house, but that's now socially acceptable. There was once a time when that wasn't socially acceptable. I think people create that society, what is socially acceptable in a society, what is not, changes over time. Post the Holocaust, it was not socially acceptable to engage in outright anti-Semitica. We now have this stereotype which makes it easier. It's not the only anti-Semitica in which people engage in, but it makes it easier. I think you have to find a way with which you're comfortable to render it once again socially unacceptable. I don't think ethnic jokes are socially acceptable. I don't think they should be. And yet there is ethnic humor. I mean, that's why I use some of those examples of the joke. I'm not saying ethnic humor is not, but when they're barbs at other people and other types, I think that's when it gets to be unacceptable.
Yeah, you were talking about how the nouveau riche kind of attitude is across the country. Do you think that the Jap stereotype is different, say, from the East Coast and the West Coast, or maybe the perception that the Jap is just a New York phenomenon?
I can tell you it's alive and well in Los Angeles. One venue, the difference is someone goes to Rodeo Drive, someone goes to Bloomingdale's. A different kind of stereotyping, but it's in both places. They go to different colleges. Maybe the East one, the East Coast one, with certain exceptions, is seen as more intellectually inclined. I don't know, but, you know, otherwise. Yeah.
Yeah, the only problem I have with this, I can see where you're coming from, that maybe a result of you being more successful and achieving things now in second and third generation and becoming too comfortable and maybe feeling a little bit insecure with that. But I think that Jews have always been insecure with where they are in society when they're overly oppressed or maybe when they're overly comfortable. And I don't see this as being any more dangerous than the Jewish humor of the past that came from Jews, except for the fact that maybe it spread to the outside community more than it has in the past. And now the Jap has become sort of a generic term for all people who are overly flashy mm-hmm. in some ways. And I don't think that there's a way that you could just come up with a new term or just try to say, you know, this is unacceptable. I think that that'll bring more of it on yourself. And by becoming too sensitive to it, I think that you'll make the problem worse.
Overreacting.
Yeah.
Just smile and shuffle along. Huh? I'm going to totally disagree with you. See, I think, first of all, if you look at Jewish humor, there are a number of good studies of Jewish humor, but the lightest sort of compendium of Jewish humor is the Big Book of Jewish Humor, which is a very good collection. But there have been also some serious studies of Jewish humor. Jewish humor laughed, Jews laughed at themselves, they laughed at their misfortune, they laughed at the shlemils, the shlemazels, they laughed at, one drops this bowl of soup, the other gets the bowl of soup dropped on him. They laughed at lots of things that happened to them. They laughed at how they used their brains sometimes to outwit the non-Jew, but the non-Jew was more powerful. The non-Jew had the power, so what did they have? They had their intellectual prowess. But you never had Jewish humor that accepted the anti-Semitic stereotypes and turned it into a way of saying, we accept these anti-Semitic stereotypes as valid, and we now laugh at those, and we turn it into humor. What it's doing is accepting this negative stereotyping that the rest of the world has of the Jew and saying that it is a valid expression. So what you're saying is that it is a legitimate expression and don't try to fight it off. What I'm saying is that there certainly are princes and princesses who happen to be Jews. There are princes and princesses who happen to be Catholic. There are princes and princes who happen to be Protestant, Oriental, whatever they might be. And to ascribe those characteristics to one particular group is to fall prey to a form of prejudice that is very dangerous, because when you look at it in its historical continuum, it the continuum is frightening.
It's called CAPS or PAPS. I mean, it's just not going to work. I mean,
yeah, but the CAPS or PAPS, that's a medical test, right? No, because I think it's too late for that. See, princess has, even when it's unspoken, it's Jewish princess. And that's the society, you know, has coming out of Jewish, you know. And the interesting thing, again, is to do an analysis of why Alfred Kazin writes like he does. And David Steinberg talks like he does, or Woody Allen or Philip Roth talks like he does.
I think your argument is strengthened, too, when you say that it's an acceptable form of anti-Semitism today. When you think about what had been done before with the Jewish woman, I remember reading a book about Jewish images in literature, and the young Jewish woman was always very positively portrayed. You think of Rebecca, think of all the other women that were presented. The Jewish woman was positive, whereas her father was the negative, and he was the dirty Jew.
Mm-hmm.
But she was always a very positive and innocent woman.
But only with one footnote, only if she had a Gentile lover. Remember? And Rebecca, she's a good
mm-hmm.
Jewess because she's got a Gentile lover. She's got to have a Gentile lover to be a good Jewess.
But it is a positive portrait.
That's the paradigmatic.
Look, the other, you want to see an expression of a strong, assertive, successful Jewish woman, read 17th century Memoirs of Glückel of Hamelin. Read that. It's a great diary of a Jewish woman, if you're interested in Jewish history, if you're interested in feminist history, you're interested in women's writing. And here's a woman who was strong, she was good in the household, she was a good businesswoman, she was assertive, she took care of the family, but it's a very, she's writing about herself, but it's treated in a very positive kind of portrayal.
About Donna Grosso.
That's right. Yes. That's right.
And it seems to me that it's not uncommon to have an anti-woman position developed within an ethnic group or racial group, which goes along with the oppression that.
That's right.
And there's something that can come out.
Right.
The other thing is that your comments about classic, I think they're very important. Personally, I don't think that the Yuppie image ever happened or is particularly popular.
I think if you looked at the Yuppie image in 84, when the Yuppies were seen as turning Gary Hart into a viable candidate before the, you know, his various boat rides and other things, that was a positive portrayal. Or Jewish, poor people who are not materialist successful. I think the young man who's no longer here, maybe he didn't like my answer. From earlier question, I think that's another point that I know many bright Jews who have not chosen to go and you know. Capable people have chosen not to go the route of material success. I don't know if they would have made it if they had chosen, but that's not the choice they made. And they said to me they're having problems in terms of making a decision for schools for their kids because now they're beginning to feel they're a little out of sync with, you know, what they've chosen.
But it's also not the whole aspect of history, which is interesting people who have politically taken positions that have supported opinions or government.
Let me, it's the hour's late, you'd be the last question, let me just answer it briefly. First of all, I think your comments about ethnic and minority groups putting down the women in their own groups is very telling. I'm not an ethno-historian, but I think that from the little I'm familiar with and the little I've read on it in relation to this kind of work, that you do see similar manifestations in the Italian community, in the black community. And the putting down of the woman. I think it's absolutely connected, and I talked about it as a anti-Semitic image because it's a given to me that it's a sexist image. I mean, you don't need, you know, that you didn't need to, you know, this is Cornell, you know, you can figure that out. That's a given. And it does parallel, I'm just going to echo most of what you said, it does parallel the rise of the feminist movement. It does, when I said, it parallels the growing assertiveness of many urban women, upscale women, many of a disproportionate number of whom happen to be Jews, because Jews happen to be a disproportionate number of that, disproportionately found in that sector of society, but not totally found. There is a Jewish working class, there always has been a Jewish working class, and maybe just as a historical footnote, if you look at the evolution of unions in this country, and I know I'm talking in school with very prominent labor history and labor relations, done work in this area and school in this area, but if you look at the history, for instance, of the International Lady Garment Workers Union, that is a union that never would have emerged and never would have been successful had it not been for the efforts of Jewish women in leading the successful strikes that took place at the early part of this century. I think that is as an important and worthy aspect of Jewish history as is so many others which deal with more what we would today think of normative Jewish activities. But I think that is extremely important, and I thank you for your comments. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. There are a bunch of speakers coming over the rest of the semester. We hope to see you again. Thank you. Thank you, Professor Lipstadt.